Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:35 on the afternoon of Wednesday, February 24th, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Wilikowski is here, Senator Coghill, myself, Senator French. The first thing we're going to do today is take up some measures that have been resting in the committee for a while and move them, and then we will turn to today's calendar. But first up is HB 186. The bill is brought to us by Representative Kelly. It's an act declaring that certain firearms and accessories are exempt from federal regulation. We've had two hearings on the matter. We've heard from the public. We've heard from alleged legal. We've heard from folks representing sort of the legal theories behind the bill. It's been discussed. We've closed public testimony. Is there a motion? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we move HB 186 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. I think if we'll do, why don't we do all three of them, and then we'll go back and we'll sign the reports. Next up is SJR 21, the measure to increase the number of legislators. It's a resolution. Again, we've had a hearing on the matter. We've taken public testimony. We heard from constitutional experts about the challenges we may get to our next redistricting if we do not do this under the Voting Rights Act. We heard from areas of rural Alaska about the impact on them if we go through a redistricting without increasing the size of the legislatures. I'm in support of the measure. Is there a motion? Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move SJR 21 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there an objection? Hearing and seeing none, the resolution's moved. Finally, there's a SB 257, an act relating to funding for youth courts. It's a bill by our colleague, Senator Egan. We had a hearing on the measure. It is non-controversial as far as I can tell. It goes from here up to the Finance Committee. Is there a motion? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we move Senate Bill 257 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, that bill is moved. We will now take a short at ease and get the paperwork straight away. And we'll go back on the record, and we are here to now take up SB 265, the revisers bill. We have Ms. Kurtz from Ledge Legal. Welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you. My name is Catherine Kurtz, and I'm an assistant reviser of statutes with Ledge Legal. And this is the revisers bill. It's something we put together annually, together with the Legislative Council, which actually approved this for introduction on February 4th. It corrects deficiencies, deals with obsolete provisions, and addresses mistakes in the statutes, among other things. Each and every section is different, but by and large, it's a bill about fixing, cleaning up the statutes, fixing problems. It has 31 sections. Fully 10 of them have to do with short titles this time around. There's also a good number that correct references or make conforming changes, and a few in the anguished English category. But overall, the Department of Law has looked at this and determined that it makes important technical changes. I think that's a nice characterization of the types of changes made in the bill. And if the committee has any questions about particular sections, I'd be happy to answer.
Ms. Kurtz, thank you. I had the opportunity to take a close look at this bill in a previous committee. So with one exception, I'm completely happy. And it's not really an exception, it's simply an amendment. I think you brought us based on some comments that were put on the record in that previous committee. We'll set the amendment aside for the time being, though, and just turn to make certain that the other committee members have had a chance to look over the bill and see whether they have any questions for you about its contents. I don't hear or see any. Well, let's go back then to an amendment that you all should have in your packets. It's 26LS1220/S.1. We'll style that amendment number one. I'll put my name on it. You all have the amendment, just to make sure. Good. I'll move the amendment and ask if there's...
I can just object so that you can tell us.
Very good. Thank you. Thanks, Senator Coghill. Ms. Kurtz, maybe you can explain the basis for the amendment, if you have a copy there.
Yes. There was a concern expressed in the Senate State Affairs Committee that Section 6 of the bill was perhaps unduly complex to get to the desired result, which is simply to substitute in the current statutory definition of limited liability partnership and foreign limited liability partnership. So all this does is change the wording to point the reader to the same place, to the same definition.
No substantive change in the meaning of the bill?
No.
Or the underlying statute?
No.
Further questions or comments on the amendment? Senator Coghill, do you maintain your objection?
No, I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
With the removal of that objection, I'll ask if there's any further objection. Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted, and that brings the bill back before us. And let's just take a moment and welcome Senator McGuire to the committee. We are deep in the recesses of the revisor's bill.
Wow.
Inviting any and all comment, or as I like to call, acid testing of the bill. Every now and then you just sort of plunge in and ask a question about a piece of the bill and see if you get anywhere. I've done that in a previous committee. I think I'm satisfied with the bill, but I want to make sure the committee is as well. So, Senator McGuire, any questions, comments about the revisor's bill? Thanks so much, Ms. Kurtz. Let's just for the record make sure that we don't have anybody on the line to talk about SB 265. Anybody here in the room that wants to testify about SB 265? Don't hear or see any. We'll go ahead and close public testimony. And that brings the bill back up in front of us. As I say, we went through this in the State Affairs Committee, so I'm happy with the bill, but I want to make sure the members of the committee are. Should we let it sit overnight and ready to go?
Yeah.
Ready to go? Okay. I'll take a motion.
So moved.
So moved.
Financial recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, SB 265 is moved out of committee. Let's go ahead and take a break and do the paperwork. Excellent. Okay, we're back on the record, and we are now going to take up SB 252, the bail bill. Ms. McLean, please come forward. And Ms. McLean, welcome to the committee. If you go ahead and put yourself on the record, maybe you can remind me how far along we got during our last hearing.
Good afternoon. My name is Sue McLean. I'm the director of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I believe that the place we stopped last time was I had introduced the bill and gone through very rapidly the sectional analysis of the bill. Senator French, you had asked me about the provision regarding the burden of proof, and I'm not sure at what point you'd like to take that up. I'm prepared to do that
Why
now.
Why don't we start with that? I think that's probably one of the areas we're going to talk about the most. So maybe you can just sort of remind us the way the law's been up until now, tell us what the bill does, and then we'll see if there's questions from members of the committee. We do have a couple other folks signed up to testify or answer questions about that as well.
All right. And if I am aware that this committee also had that raised in a letter from Mr. Mittman from the ACLU, one way to go through it may be to talk about his letter.
That'd be fine. That'd be okay. Actually, that'd be all right. A good way to take it up. Thank you.
In Section 4 of the bill, specifically on page 7 of the bill, line 19 on bill proposes that when persons are charged with certain types of crimes, specific crimes, there is a presumption that no condition of release or no amount of bail can assure their appearance or the safety of the community. This part of the bill tracks exactly the federal statute. The federal statute has been examined in every federal circuit. None have found it to be unconstitutional. They focus primarily on what is an extremely important reminder in this bill, which is this bill does not in any way deny or attempt to deny the right to bail. We acknowledge that a defendant always has the right to bail under the U.S. Constitution and under the Alaska Constitution. Now, that's a little bit different from, we have a lot of case law that says the defendant does not, therefore, have a right to release. The defendant has a right to bail. And that's an important distinction. In order to ensure the safety of the community, there is a lot of case law that talks about high bail and reasonable conditions for those who first would flee or second might pose a danger. What this provision does do, however, is set a framework in which the court, and it begins that way, that what the court might consider, in which the court discusses the issue of bail in certain kinds of cases. And the rationale is that certain kind of cases present either an enhanced risk that someone will flee, or by the facts of the case, an obvious risk to the community. Obviously, many of these are sexual assault in the first degree, murder in the first degree, murder in any degree, have a 99-year sentence. Some of those sentences would be applying to people for whom they're mandatory because they're here for the second or third time. And the obvious risk there is that they will flee. There is a sub-risk, given the types of crimes, which is that the person is presenting a danger to the community and conditions haven't worked. I think the one where that's most obvious is when the person is alleged to have committed a new offense while they're on conditions of release. But the answer to the question about the Constitution, I think, is that it's important to remember that the burden here is not the burden of proof. It's the burden of going forward. It's simply the burden of production. That is, there's an indictment or information setting out probable cause and a strong case, a reason to believe the person has committed the crime. The defendant has the burden of going forward with evidence, a preponderance of the evidence, to show what conditions might be imposed, what bail might be imposed that will assure that he'll appear or she'll appear and that the community will be safe. In response to that, the state always has the burden and continues to have the burden of persuasion, that is the burden of proof, to show by clear and convincing evidence that the person is a danger or there is not any bail amount that will ensure his appearance. So that's the answer to that question, and that's where the federal courts have come down on that statute.
Let me just jump in and just make sure that, so it's, you're saying that the list of crimes beginning on line 23, unclassified felony, class A felony, sexual felony, et cetera, those are all exactly analogous to the federal bail statute.
Yeah, and actually the federal bail statute includes some other offenses, such as certain kinds of drug offenses, people that are accused of being terrorists, things like that. It does include actually quite a bit of drug offenses, RICO offenses, those kind of crimes, organized crime offenses, and we don't include those in our proposal.
And let me just ask two questions. One, would this there was a recent case in Anchorage, an egregious case of a woman who was on release, I believe, for DWI, who in the course of an afternoon killed a Anchorage citizen while under the influence. Would her bail conditions have been grabbed by this statute? Would she have had to overcome a rebuttable presumption that she couldn't be released?
Yes, if I may, I'm turning to the right page here. That would fall under, I'm looking at page 7, line 29. That she was charged with an offense which was committed while she was on release under this chapter for a charge or conviction of another offense.
Right. What's called a vehicular homicide, for lack of a better word. I don't know what she's exactly been charged with. That would fall under this. But how about the conditions of release she was under? Would this bail statute have made it more difficult for her to get out of jail in the first place? I guess that's the better question.
No.
Okay.
I mean, the short answer to that is no, not unless she had some kind of prior record that
she was on release for a garden variety DWI.
No,
right.
It wouldn't have made it any.
So this wouldn't capture that.
No.
And so let me ask, and maybe this is the subject of a memo to the committee or to me that we can distribute, but I guess my question is maybe bigger. What bail decisions are being made in the state right now that require us to act in this manner? That is which jurisdictions, which judges, which charges, and I know it's broad, but I guess I'm just looking for a couple of examples of where our courts are letting us down with bail decisions.
You know, I cannot refer specifically to specific judges or specific cases. I can speak generally, anecdotally, about the kind of things I hear from our lawyers about bail, which is that they go into court, and we have courts that regard the right to bail as analogous to the right to release, and that there are releases happening where, for example, the most common one, and I certainly anecdotally could tell you about hundreds of examples from my own experience, where the person has a pending charge, and they come in, they've been released OR, and they're being released OR again, and the new charge is far more serious. Another one that I personally am aware of is a person who was released OR that was charged with a sexual felony and returned to the village where the crime occurred, and it was a village of 50 people. That's a very difficult situation in which to protect the young victims of that offense. It was a sexual abuse of a minor. Typically, sexual assault cases where the person is an adult, you know, eventually they'll be released. And where is the person to go but to the village that they live in? I mean, the defendant doesn't have another place to go usually. So those are the kind of things we're hearing anecdotally, that what we're really asking for is for everyone to stop and take a breath and look at the case we have and have the court look at the subject of bail from this context, which is, here are some factors you should consider and presume, it is a presumption, that the defendant is dangerous or that people can't be protected, and that the defendant should come forward with an explanation about why he is not. I would say that one thing about this bill is it makes no, it does not attempt in any way to set any kind of rules about what kind of evidence might be proposed. It might be as simple as, I'd like to propose my mother as the third party custodian, you know. This certainly is happening now, and it could continue to happen. But explain to this judge why you will show up or why you will not be dangerous if you're released. That's really what it's about.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Coghill.
As a process question, I understand, no, help me understand. From the time somebody is arrested and charged to the time that they're indicted, say, for one of these higher class felonies, and how the bail works from one to the other, or is there a difference?
There is a difference. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, when a person is arrested, they're brought before a judicial officer immediately, and that person sets bail. And typically, if it's a serious offense, bail will be set quite high, or conditions will be very difficult to meet. The person, if they're charged with a felony, has the right to a preliminary hearing or an indictment within 10 days if they remain in custody. Anchorage is a little bit different in that it has a pretrial program for, pre-indictment program, but most, all of our other offices usually try to get the case to a grand jury or a preliminary hearing within 10 days. At that point, we revisit the subject of bail before the Superior Court. By the time those 10 days have passed, the person may have come up with a plan that can assure that people are safe or that he or she will appear as ordered. But often the bail that's set at the Magistrate Court is simply continued. Is that responsive?
Chairman, and that's what I was trying to get my mind set. This would probably be after indictment issues, what we're talking about here. Is that true?
It applies to an initial bail setting, actually.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I don't know if you're the right person to answer this, but I'm having a hard time seeing how this could possibly have a zero fiscal note. This would seem to have fairly enormous fiscal note, because I'm imagining you're going to have huge numbers of people who are all of a sudden denied bail and sitting in our corrections facilities or small jails somewhere. Am I wrong?
Through the chair, through the Department of Law is going to bail hearings. It's not going to change what we do. It may well change what corrections does.
Okay.
But I can't speak to their fiscal note.
We've got folks from courts and corrections here we'll speak to before the hearing's out regarding the fiscal impact of this specific provision. I think it's a good point. Just maybe so we're all clear, bail is set when you're charged with a crime. Bail continues until you're either found innocent or guilty, and at that point you're in a different status.
That's correct. Sometimes the bail is, in minor offenses, is on recognizance. There's no bail that needs to be posted. You're just given some conditions.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had, and I guess it ties in somewhat to this, but I've had calls recently and emails from victims' rights advocates who have been concerned about, from a victim's perspective, the length of court cases. And I'm wondering if you would have any objection. I know we have a constitutional right, victims do, but I'm wondering if there would be any sort of opposition or if you've given any thought to the idea of putting in statute victims' rights as it pertains to timely disposition of a case.
Actually, I think that the constitutional provision has something like that in it.
It does. It's extremely broad, and there are other states that have much more specific definitions of timely disposition. And I'm just curious if you've given that any thought. I've had someone who victims' rights advocates who've been calling me and asking me about this, and I said I would ask it if I saw a bill that came through, and this one looks sort of like one that you might be able to do that with. Do you have any position on that?
Through the chair, I certainly am happy to discuss it with our department. I will tell you that, as you know, the time for trial is 4 months, and the state always has to assume that we're going to trial in 4 months. It is typically the reason that cases are continued, not always, but often, because the defense attorney needs more time to look at the discovery and prepare for the case, and the defendant waives the time. And I recognize that that can be, when cases drag on, extremely difficult for victims. I agree. I hear those same things.
Yeah, I'd love to see any language you have, Senator Wilkowski, from other jurisdictions. It's something I've thought about. I know it's on the mind of the Department of Law. Victims do sort of get the short end of the stick. It's like the defendant can pick when he wants to go to trial. by waiving time or not waiving time, and it's frustrating. I know that courts are reluctant to push that because of concerns about being overturned on appeal.
Thank you.
Let's stay on the bail question, though, for another couple of minutes. Anything more from you, Ms. McLean,
about the
bail issue? Maybe I should ask whether you or someone through analysis through your databases and your case processing software could give us a sense of how many cases per year this would pertain to. You know, are we affecting 100 defendants, 1,000 defendants? You know, how many folks are going to be captured by this, you know, fairly significant change in the law?
Actually, I could probably come up with that fairly rapidly,
Senator.
That'd
be great. When you can transmit it to my office, and we'll transmit it to the committee. But it's a big change, and I recognize the feds have done it. But again, their Eighth Amendment is not the same as our Eighth Amendment, even if
12th.
12. Thanks.
Article 1, Section 12.
That's why you're in that chair, and I'm glad you are. Further questions for Ms. McLean while we have her here about the bail statute? No, thanks.
Okay.
We'll go ahead. I think we'll focus on this for a few minutes, and then we'll come back to you for more on the bill.
Okay. But so we're just talking about the bail part of it now,
exactly.
And then we'll come back and talk about the failures to appear.
Yes.
And, thank you,
yes.
Sir.
Yeah, I think we've got folks here to talk about that, and while it's uppermost in our minds, we'll go ahead and turn to them. Let's go ahead and Doug Wolliver's here. Mr. Wolliver, welcome. Go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. The court's been working with the Department of Law on a number of provisions on this bill. Some we have concerns about and some we just have questions about. We've got a meeting next week scheduled too with one of our retired judges with the department, so we hope to work through a lot of issues. On the bail issue, we don't, as usual, take a position on whether that's a good idea or bad idea, constitutional or not. But we seem to have a different view of the impact, like you, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. We see the presumption, at least the initial burden, as Ms. McLean said, to go forward, as adding a fair amount of time to bail hearings in a significant number of cases. That may be a good idea. She said, you know, the point is stop, slow down, take a breath, and do these more carefully. That may be a very good idea, but it takes time. And when you're doing numerous bail hearings every afternoon in Anchorage, we see a pretty significant impact on the court. Now, the Department of Law and Public Defender and OPAL have zero fiscal notes, so I'm not sure we're seeing eye to eye on what the impact will be. Perhaps we don't understand the provision very well, or perhaps we just need to get a better handle on it. But when we looked at those provisions, most of the comments I've received from judges are, these are going to take a lot more time. Maybe they should, but there's a fiscal impact on that. We don't have a fiscal note on the bill at this point. But in large part because we have been working with the department, and some of the changes that might happen to the bill might significantly change what our fiscal analysis will be.
Mr. Wolver, are you or someone from the courts working on a fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Okay. So it's yours to deliver.
It's mine to deliver.
And for the time being, though, it sounds like you're, I don't know, I don't want to say in a process of negotiation, but maybe you can just describe to me what's going to come from the conversations you have with the Department of Law regarding this provision, or what you hope will come.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. There are a couple parts of the bill that we would like to see changed, and I can go over at least one of those with you. Now, it's not on the bail issue, though, so I don't know if you want to take that up later. Or
we'll
not
bail, but first, and then while I've got you here, we'll do the other.
But
one.
I guess on the bail one, it's we can also come up with a pretty good count of exactly how many cases a year are subject to that that provision.
I'd be interested in knowing that from you as well.
And then we'll look at that and say, you know, I'll talk to judges and say, how much extra time do you think it takes to do a hearing that looks like this, and how many hundreds or thousands of these do we see each year. And then we'll come up with some type of an analysis on that. And we'll talk to the Department of Law, and we'll talk to the public defender and see if they're seeing these things the same way. If they are and they still want to go forward and we think it's going to be very expensive and time-consuming, we'll have a fiscal note on that. And if they think, okay, well, you're right, maybe this is more than we want, maybe we'll get it changed. We don't, for this provision, we don't really care whether we have it or not. We just want to make sure that we have the resources to deal with it when we do. And since we see a big impact, they see no impact, I think we need to talk to figure out what exactly is going to happen in these hearings.
My question for the court system would be, how many bail hearings do you conduct statewide right now? Mm-hmm. And then how many of those bail hearings would be subject to these new rules, were they to be adopted? So I get a feel for the percentage. Is it 5? I mean, I'm going to guess it's not an overwhelming percentage because these are fairly serious crimes or fairly narrow circumstances. But, you know, is it 5%, 10%, a quarter? You know, what is it?
Mr. Chairman, I'll find that. I know that in general our CourtView courts see about 11,000 bail hearings a year.
Okay.
But I don't know how many of the – I mean, it's actually – it could be more than that because some hearings cover a number of things, including bail. It might not show up in our system as a bail hearing, but, in fact, bail is addressed. One of the judges said it's probably more like 15,000 a year. But I don't know exactly in what stage each one of those is or what type of offenses. But I can find out how many offenses would be covered by this presumptive change.
Sure. I mean, you look at the number of bail hearings, look at how many would, which of those bail hearings would be captured under this.
Right. And I can make an estimate.
That's very good. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. Yeah, and I'd also be really interested in hearing the time that you would associate, the additional time for each one of these hearings. I think this is going to be an enormous amount of time, is just my guess, because if you are now requiring, you have 15,000 hearings, and if this only covers 10%, that's still 1,500 people. And I see these hearings as going on potentially hours, if not days, each one. So, but you're the experts, and I'd just be interested to really get a grasp on what we're doing here.
And through the chair, I'm going to try to find that out. Thank
you. Sure. While we have you here, there was another provision of the bill you wanted to let us alert us to.
Yes, there is a provision. This is on page 3, line 4, section 3, which is page 4, line 14 through 16. And this is the part that has the clerk of court doing a criminal background check in the court records before a second bail review hearing can proceed. We have a number of concerns about this. First of all, it's an adversarial system. The prosecution and defense should have already presented to the court all the criminal background information that's relevant to any bail decision. It would have been presented either at the first hearing, and Department of Law remembers this bill gives them 48 hours specifically to better prepare for a bail hearing. There's already been a bail review hearing once before, in which case the parties should have brought that information to the court. And even if the court were to do this, it's an incomplete record. All we have are state cases. We have no out-of-state cases, so there could be all kinds of cases that are not covered by this. It's very time-consuming. You don't just hit a button and show the person's entire criminal history. There's a lot of steps that have to be gone through, particularly in the non-computerized courts, about how these are done. It's time-consuming and expensive, and because it should have already been presented to the court at least once and probably twice, I think it's redundant. So that provision we'd very much like to see removed. And I've talked to the Department of Law, and we'll see whether they agree eventually or not. But that's a provision we would like to see removed from the bill.
And just so we're all clear, that's the provision that's on lines 14 to 16 of page 4, the part that asks essentially the court to consult its own records, is the way it looks to me, before granting a second or subsequent bail hearing.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. For questions or comments to Mr. Wolliver about that? I don't see any. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Let's turn to Dwayne Peoples from the Department of Corrections. And we'll talk about bail for a minute. Mr. Peoples, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dwayne Peoples, Department of Corrections.
And Mr. Peoples, you've had a chance to look at the change in the bail statute that the Department of Law is proposing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And what can you tell us about its potential fiscal impact upon the Department of Corrections?
Looking at our database, and until we kind of figure out how courts are going to handle this, for us, it is A, very difficult to determine, and two, the number of man days for somebody convicted would probably not change. If you look on our fiscal note on the second page in the narrative, we identify that this would cause a shift to the jail part, the unsentenced part. If somebody who is accused of a crime cannot get bail, and this would go back to how the courts are going to manage it, then they would be in the jail part till the adjudication process is completed. But when your sentence comes down, the sentence would include the time served as during your unadjudicated phase and your jail phase. So the total overall man days may not change, and that's why we've kind of put in a zero fiscal note. But what you will see is a shift more towards the impact in the jails and not in the prison part. If it's short-term sentencing, domestic violence flags, say 80 days, 90 days, 100 days, that won't impact it. If it is, because you're still going to be in the jails, you'll be in the local jails. If it's a long-term sentence, you would be going to one of our sentence facilities, and again, the total sentencing won't change because you have served your time during the adjudication process. So it's sort of hard to guess, but so that's why we have a zero fiscal note at this point in time.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, I guess there are people who, I was very surprised to see a zero fiscal note and not an indeterminate. I mean, it seems like an indeterminate's really more appropriate because you're going to have people who are found innocent, right, who have served time and that they wouldn't have. And so right there you've got a fiscal impact. No.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, and that for us is very hard to determine. We put in an indeterminate, and we're told to bring it back. You know, if you can't figure it out, give us a zero. So we flag it as a footnote or in the narrative. For us, we can't figure it out at this point in time. I think maybe when we start looking at what courts will be producing, we can come back and see if we can get a better handle on it.
Mr. Peoples, maybe you can just sort of walk us through how this might work out in an area such as Southeast, where you've got small jails available to you, say in Sitka, and yet your longer-term facility is here in Juneau. It sounds to me like you're concerned that you could wind up filling the jail in Sitka or having to transport folks from there to a longer-term facility on the denial of their bail. You know, individuals who used to be released in Sitka back into the community awaiting the resolution of their trial would now be kept in jail and then transported to Juneau. I mean, you can see something like that happening.
To the chair, yes, that could happen. There's a lot of small communities that have jails, and each jail has a limitation on how long somebody can be held. These will be anywhere from 1 week to 3 weeks to 30 days. If they are denied bail by the local magistrate and or court, at some point in time, that person would have to be transported into the regional jails, such as in Lemon Creek for Sitka, and that would be primarily done by the Department of Public Safety.
On the other hand, I can hear Ms. McClain pointing out that, hey, these are people that are charged with unclassified felonies, Class A felonies, sex felonies. They've been convicted of a felony somewhere else, and they've just done another one. I mean, these are not, sort of guys picked up on their first DWIs or on a vandalism charge or so forth. These are fairly serious offenses. Further questions for Mr. Peoples? Don't see any. Thank you. Let's turn. We've got Rodney Dial, Jeff Mittman, and Quinn Steiner on the phone, mostly to answer questions, but I see Mr. Mittman wanted to testify. Mr. Mittman, are you there?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Actually, why don't you go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'll take your testimony now.
Sure. This is Jeffrey Mittman with the ACLU of Alaska. And, for the Chair, would it be better just to limit testimony at this point to the section we've been discussing?
Why don't you go ahead and testify on all aspects of the bill, and we'll circle back around to the bail and maybe have a little bit more of a conversation about that. But while we've got you on the line, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony about the bill as a whole?
Certainly. As a whole, we have previously submitted written testimony to the committee, and as the committee is aware, the orientation the ACLU takes is purely from a constitutional rights and civil liberties perspective. We analyze the bill. There's certainly a policy perspective, but our initial orientation is the bill written in such a way that the statutes it would set up would be in compliance with both the U.S. and, in this case in particular, the Alaska constitutions. Perhaps the leading case on this question, again, this was referenced in our written testimony, is the matter of Martin v. State. That was a case heard by the Supreme Court in 1974. That's the Supreme Court of Alaska. And I think what's important to remember is there, after a brief review of federal constitutional standards, the Supreme Court noted it is not necessary in this appeal to decide whether appellants were entitled to bail under the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. They then went through a rather lengthy review, as you would imagine, of the Alaska Constitution. Overall, if I can do another brief quote from the case, the Supreme Court stated, "Our study of Article 1, Section 11, thus compels the conclusion that the Alaska Constitution, without doubt, guarantees to every accused person the right to be released on bail, except for capital offenses where the proof is evident or the presumption great." It discusses limitations in other states and notes. In Alaska, such an implied limitation would necessarily contravene both the plain language of this constitutional provision and its intended purpose as stated at the Constitutional Convention. So overall, the orientation we're taking is that the Supreme Court has been fairly clear in interpreting a very specific provision of the Alaska Constitution, which is clearly of greater import and greater protection than the federal standard. We noted in our written testimony various issues in terms of either changing presumption, improperly limiting an individual's right to hearing. And, of course, the issue here is that prior to trial, a person accused of crime is presumed innocent and essentially has the presumption to liberty that a non-charged person would have. Clearly, a bail hearing is an important issue, and the court can and should consider information regarding the safety of the community and whether or not the accused is a flight risk. But what this bill overall does, and I'll be happy to answer questions as to each individual section, what this bill overall does is unconstitutionally reverse the intention of the Constitution.
And Mr. Mittman, you are aware, of course, that there's a parallel provision to the one being proposed here by the Department of Law in federal criminal in the federal criminal code.
Correct. And again, I'm sorry.
That's it. Do you want to comment on that?
Again, I think the important standard here is what the ACLU does on constitutional matters is look at both the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights and specific provisions of the Alaska Constitution. And as the Chair has noted, the Alaska Constitution is very specific on this matter. And again, referring to State v. Martin, it is clear that in Alaska, the bail provision is of specific import to the drafters. The decision in State v. Martin notes comments of Constitutional Delegate Vic Fisher in specifically amending it to narrow the limitations on granting of bail. So that there is a federal bill which may allow for more strict limitations on bail hearings or a granting of bail, in this case, is rendered moot by the Alaska Constitution and the decision in State v. Martin.
Mr. Mittman, I wonder if maybe we should just call Vic Fisher up and ask him what he thinks.
I think that would be a wonderful idea, Mr. Chair. We're always happy to hear from Mr. Fisher.
It's just a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk to one of the drafters of the Constitution. Further comments, Mr. Mittman, on this aspect of the bill or others?
Since we are talking about the sections on page 7, the rebuttable presumption is obviously problematic. What the Constitution sets up is a presumption that an accused, and again, this is not a person who's been convicted of a crime, this is a person who has been charged, there is a presumption in the Constitution that an accused has a right to bail and that the prosecution has the responsibility to establish for the court why that bail should not be allowed. Trying to reverse through statute this presumption is just not permissible. So in this case, obviously, this would be highly problematic. I think it would be subject to almost immediate litigation. And again, given the decision in State v. Martin, I don't think there's a big question as to where this would end up.
Thank you, Mr. Mittman. Questions or comments from members of the committee for Jeff Mittman? Senator McGuire.
I appreciate the comments. I think it is important that we always remember we have our own unique constitution and case law that springs from it. And really not for Mr. Mittman, but I guess just broader for the committee, that I wonder if the support isn't gained for the bill, if we can't go there constitutionally as a group. I wonder if the place to think about it is in conditions upon release. And I guess I'm looking to you, Mr. Chairman, as somebody who was a prosecutor. There's the bail hearing, and there's an opportunity at that bail hearing to go ahead and set bail. And obviously, the monetary amount at which bail is set sometimes is a way to kind of serve as a measure of the threat to society. But my understanding is there are other conditions that can be set as well. If it's an alcohol violation, that the accused cannot be, should not be consuming alcohol, and if they are, that's an automatic violation. If it has to do with sexual assault, in this case, what I'm thinking about, the Village example, sexual assault of a minor or domestic violence, that what we could do is consider the ability of expanding, a requirement that the person not be within a certain proximity of the victim. And again, I recognize they're accused. They have a right to be deemed innocent until proven guilty, but I'm sympathetic to the AG. I'm sympathetic to the sort of the philosophy behind the bill that you have innocent, vulnerable victims and that these are hasty hearings, that there isn't as much evidence as we might want in order to process the level of threat to society. And so I guess I just kind of want to go down that path for a minute, that maybe it's a matter of looking at conditions at the bail hearing itself as opposed to holding somebody in prison and forcing the presumption.
I think it's a good conversation to have. Clearly, the most protection you can give the public is to keep someone in jail, but there's an enormous, there are costs and risks to that approach as well. Whether you can absolutely forbid someone from returning to their home, what sort of costs result from that are questions that you're raising in your thoughts, and I don't have a simple answer. I wish I did.
There's something for us to keep in mind.
Right. Let me turn to Quinn Steiner. If Quinn Steiner's on the line, Quinlan Steiner.
Mr. Chairman.
There you are. Welcome to the committee. Why don't you go ahead and put yourself on the record?
Thank you. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm with the public defender for the state of Alaska.
Have you been following the conversation? We're focused here on the change in the presumption regarding release on bail.
I have. And I wanted to note just a couple of things. I think one of the impacts is there is going to be constitutional challenges to this section of the statute based upon the arguments laid out by Mr. Mittman. And primarily this is because of a practical problem that's created by shifting the burden of production to the defense. One of the components that needs to be weighed in a bail hearing is the strength of the state's case. Normally, defense can rely on the state having to meet its burden of proving that the bail isn't sufficient, but here that's not the case. They would have to meet some burden of going forward to put the state to its burden. And that may, you know, require putting on and disclosing the defense view of the case, which doesn't have to occur now. And that's particularly problematic, both in terms of the constitutional arguments and the time that these hearings would take. If you were to fail to address that issue, which really is the only distinction, because this burden is juxtaposed against the way that you're charged and the crime that you're charged with, so it puts the state's case directly at issue and rebutting it directly in the bail hearing in a way that is not presently the case. I would also note that this does appear to me to cover more than just the higher level felony cases. It appears to me that in subsection C, that would apply to the lowest level of misdemeanors. Even a repeat, say, criminal trespass would be subject to this kind of bail hearing, you know, were that person to commit a subsequent trespass while on conditions of release.
Mr. Steiner, let me ask you this. Have you consulted with your colleagues in the Federal Public Defender's Office about how this statute works out for them in their practice?
Mr. Chairman, I have not, but I certainly can, and after this conversation, would do so.
I guess I would encourage you to contact Rich Kirtner, yeah, for example, and just see if, you know, Senator Wilikowski is right. See whether, you know, federal bail hearings are, you know, much more complex, whether they go on longer. You know, do you have to, you know, sort of start with a character witness on your side to get the ball rolling, to get the judge, you know, to sort of to rebut the presumption that you can't be released? You know, what sort of evidentiary hearings do bail hearings turn into? I mean, right now it's basically, you know, the DA makes the case. You know, the defense attorney makes the case, the judge, you know, looks over the facts and makes a decision. It's fairly straightforward. They can go on for a while, but it's fairly straightforward. And I just wonder, you know, how complex or how lengthy these hearings can get once
Mr. Chairman, I'll certainly do that after this hearing.
Yep.
Yeah, that is one of the questions that is raised by this. As that relates to the fiscal note being zero, it's sort of unpredictable for us. I mean, it's potentially possible that people would simply abandon their bail hearing in the face of this, and I'm not sure how long this is going to drag out bail hearings or precisely how many cases this will apply to. I think it'll help in evaluating that, getting some direct numbers from either courts or corrections on that would certainly help that discussion.
Senator Coghill has a question, but before he asks this question, I'll just comment that I guess I'm surprised that your fiscal note is zero as well. I fail to see how this doesn't create more work for your agency, but
Mr. Chairman, it's really more a question of predictability. There's no way for me to come up with a defensible number at this point. I just don't know if it will or not.
Fair enough. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, because of the previous testimony and this testimony on constitutional issues, I guess I'd probably have to do some studying. But because of the nature of capital punishment, and we've never had capital punishment in Alaska from the time of statehood to now, then what we're doing is we're looking at the most egregious crimes and trying to figure out what we can do with bail. I think during the Constitutional Convention it was supposed that under the most egregious conditions there would be reasonable reason to hold somebody. So under some of the conditions here, I think that except for subsection C, I think we might actually have a good case, and especially when you look at section 24 of Article 1, which says that they can be reasonably protected, the accused, I mean the victim, that can be reasonably protected from the accused through imposition of appropriate bail or conditions of release by the court. And so that puts two constitutional provisions in the test as we're talking here. So I don't know that I would just out of hand call it unconstitutional, since that at the very beginning we agreed that under capital offenses that would rise to this level. So I'm trying to balance that as I'm listening to this. Except for subsection C, I think we might actually have something to work on.
Good comments, Senator Coghill. Thank you. Just for the record, you were reading from basically the Victims' Rights Amendment.
Yes, that's section 24 of Article 1.
Thank you. Further committee discussion on this perplexing provision? Don't see any. Thank you. Ms. McLean, maybe you can come back, and that brings the rest of the bill back up to us. You were mentioning failure to appear, I think, and some other provisions that we should go over.
Frankly, I found the easiest way to do, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, found the easiest way to do this was to run, in some respects, I recognize time is an issue here, to kind of run through these.
You've got nothing but time.
In the order that Mr. Mittman presented them, sure, in his letter, which I think gives us a context. The second part of Mr. Mittman's letter talked about courts imposing, I believe he referred to it as a unconstitutional expansion of court authority. I would point out that most of these conditions already exist under current law and in Section 12-20-030. And courts already are imposing them. Specifically, the ACLU was concerned about the condition that someone keep the job they have. From our point of view, we don't see that much differently than don't leave town. But really, I can't tell you how frequently we hear that the reason that the person needs to be out with no bail right now is because they'll lose their job. And so when they are released and the next day quit their job, if there wasn't a condition that said keep it, it's simply a mockery, frankly. Same with someone is making an argument that they need to get out to look for a job. It doesn't seem unreasonable to have the court include in the release order, look for a job. That's what you said you would do. I understand the argument about medication. That does sound sort of draconian, I guess, if you thought of it that way. But the bill specifically provides that this applies to people that are already on medication. And what we know is, sadly, the criminal justice system is dealing with a lot of people who are mentally ill, and as a result of not taking their medication, they commit crimes. When they're taking their medication, we don't see them. It's a reasonable condition of release, and it's aimed at making sure that the person can be released. It's not gauged to make the person's life after they're released miserable. It's really set out to protect the public and ensure that the person can be released and the public can be protected in the same, that both of those goals can be made. Failure to appear has been a crime since 1966. I don't know of any states that don't have some sort of bail jumping, failure to appear crime. That's the next item on in Mr. Mittman's letter. I was perplexed by his reference, and it may be that you want to speak to him more about that later, to parole violators, tripling the number of people in jail, and that somehow changing the crime of failure to appear would increase the number of people in jail. Parole violators are not being charged with failure to appear. They're people that have been sentenced and are released either on mandatory or discretionary parole and are alleged to have violated it either by drinking or by committing new crimes or by doing whatever they were told not to do. It has nothing to do with appearance. What the bill does do and what the real issue here is that there was a case in which the Court of Appeals defined an element in the crime of failure to appear that we frankly didn't think was there. We being the Department of Law, have always assumed that the elements of failure to appear, which we would propose to move from Title 12 to Title 11 because it's a crime and has always had criminal penalties, were that the state had to prove that the defendant knew what the defendant's conditions of release were and that the defendant failed to appear for court. This proposal simply says those are the elements and gives the defendant the affirmative defense of saying, I couldn't appear. Here are my reasons. And quite frankly, in practice, if we're hearing those reasons or the defendant is calling up the court saying, I can't show up, those people aren't being prosecuted for failure to appear. It's those that simply disappear. They get, and, you know, a bench warrant is issued, and basically it just clarifies. The purpose of this provision is for the legislature to clarify what its understanding was of the elements of failure to appear. Mr. Mittman talked about Section 3 and the time being changed for a bail hearing. Actually, Section 3 deals with the current law as it currently exists under AS 1230020, which says if a person is held, the prosecution has 48 hours in which to ask that that person be detained so the prosecution can come forward with evidence showing that the person is dangerous or reasons why they should be continue to be held. And Section 1230.020F currently provides that a person who remains in custody 48 hours after the original bail is set has the right to a hearing, a bail review, to one bail review. This statute doesn't change those at all. What it does do in Section 20 is ask for a change to Criminal Rule 5, allowing that the state has up to 48 hours, the state and the court, to have someone appear initially for their first appearance, whereas the rule right now is 24. The preference is always to get someone before a judicial officer as quickly as possible. In Anchorage, there's a magistrate court. It's open 24 hours a day. That is not true anywhere else. And sometimes it's simply not possible to get someone to court within 24 hours of their arrest. Sometimes we need that extra time to figure out what happened.
On that point, Ms. McLean, maybe you can tell us at a future hearing how many jurisdictions. I'm going to guess that the majority rule is 24 hours between arrest and arraignment, but you can educate me if I'm mistaken, or let us know how many jurisdictions embrace the 48-hour rule. We'll call it the 48-hour.
I will find that.
Great.
If I may continue.
Please.
Another aspect to the letter from the ACLU is the argument that conditions of release now encompass warrantless search, specifically in cases involving use of alcohol, that the person be ordered not to use alcohol and to submit to a search for alcohol and to submit to a breath test as a condition of release. Those conditions exist already. They are also in AS 1230.023, and Mr. Mittman cited a Ninth Circuit case in which he cites for the proposition that the Ninth Circuit endorsed the rights of pretrial defendants to be free of suspicionless searches. We do too. We don't think anybody ought to be searching without a reasonable suspicion, but frankly, these conditions of release have been in effect for as long as I have practiced law, and that's a long time. And they're reasonable. What the case law says is that there should be a nexus between conditions of release and what the person is charged with. Here, the alcohol conditions apply to people charged with an alcohol offense. The drug conditions apply to a person charged with a drug offense. Finally, Mr. Mittman had concern about the third-party custodians.
Which provision is that?
If I may find it, it's going to take a minute. Just a moment here. Take me a minute. Page 10. Thank you.
There it is, yep. Section 5.
Section 5. Thank you very much, sir. There's a presupposition in the letter that we're creating third-party custodians. There have always been third-party custodians. The court has always been permitted to require a third-party custodian in addition to other conditions. The current law is at AS 1230.030B. What this changes is setting conditions or setting qualifications for third-party custodians. Don't necessarily think that third-party custodians are a bad idea. I did notice the ACLU letter talks about the court sort of foisting that requirement upon defendants when they don't want a third-party custodian. And I think in some cases the court is saying, you know, in addition to your bail, I want somebody watching you. But I can also say in as many cases what we see is a defendant coming forward on a bail review saying, I can't make bail, but I could propose this third-party custodian to watch me so that I could be released OR. Our concern is that there are presently, so far as I know, no conditions, no requirements for what a third-party custodian ought to be able to do, and these are really some simple requirements, like don't have a pending charge yourself, actually be able physically to see and hear the defendant you're agreeing to watch 24 hours a day, not be on felony probation, those kind of really actually minimal requirements you would expect for someone who's going to take responsibility to watch over someone who's on conditions of release from jail. One of those that we have concern about is that people who are doing it for money, as a job. It was always our understanding that the legislature's vision here was that you would go to someone known to you who is a friend or family member who could take care of you and sort of help you, if you're on release, not get yourself in trouble. So those are my responses to the ACLU's letter. The one other thing I would like to mention, just since we proposed this bill, is it was brought to my attention today. On page 10, line 7, having to do with release in domestic violence cases, I make sure I have the right page here. I think I do. Release would be required that the person not contact someone by telephone, directly or indirectly, not contact the victim by telephone or electronic mail. And a request was made that we change that to electronic communication so that there isn't a parsing out of what is electronic mail. Is it texting? Is it tweeting? Or is that a telephone? And we certainly wouldn't have any objection to that change.
So we'll make a note there. That's page 10. Line 8,
thank you.
A suggested change to communication from mail.
Thank you. That being said, those are my comments about the letter.
Very good. Thank you. Further questions for Ms. McLean? I don't see any.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is a large bill. It's something that we're going to be working on for some time. And so we'll set it aside for the time being. But we do have one other large bill we want to get started on, and that's SB 241. And it looks like we have someone here to talk about that.
We do have someone.
Ms. Carpinetti, welcome to the committee. Thank you, Ms. McLean.
Thank you.
This is the last of the trio of the governor's large crime bills. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and we appreciate your scheduling a hearing on SB 241 today. It's a two-part bill. One part you folks, I think, are pretty familiar with, the evidence retention bill portion of the bill, and I know that this committee worked really hard on a similar bill last session, and we really appreciate your work, and I think SB 241 is reasonably similar. There are a few changes or a few differences that I could describe for you, and you may want to just not even listen to me in that regard, but the governor thought that it would be a good idea to have both of these interrelated subjects in one bill because they are really dependent on each other in many ways. So that's why we kind of reprised evidence retention. The other half of the bill is post-conviction standards for procedures for dealing with requests for post-conviction DNA testing. And they were drafted, I'm very proud to say, by Ken Rosenstein and Diane Winlett, who represented us in the United States Supreme Court. And they are based on the federal law in terms of their bill, which actually in the argument in the United States Supreme Court, the Innocence Project actually agreed that the federal law is kind of the standard that states should aspire to in terms of adopting such a procedure. This is based on that. There are some changes, and I'm sure that there are people who disagree with those changes. But our intent in drafting this bill is to adopt a balance which would allow people who are innocent to bring a claim of a request for post-conviction DNA testing. Nobody wants an innocent person in jail. At the same time, most convictions are based on evidence and they're fair convictions, and there's no reason to upset them unless you can show that there is a reason to upset them, because a person who's convicted has had a conviction either by a guilty plea or by a jury verdict and has an opportunity to appeal that conviction, has had an opportunity to bring other claims for post-conviction release. So we really want to achieve a balance that does allow somebody who is actually innocent to bring that claim. Maybe the first thing I could do was just to describe to you the few differences between 110 and SB 110 and this bill. The first difference is that SB 214 sets a time frame for keeping evidence that is not biological material, and the time frame that the the time frame that the bill adopts is really at the end of all possible litigation regarding that particular case, and that is after the time frame has, if you've appealed to the Ninth Circuit and you've taken a writ to the United States Supreme Court, after that is denied, or a certain period after that's denied, or after it has been granted. SB 110 provided that evidence that is not biological material should be kept until the case is solved, and that would probably work. That does work, and I think it sort of depends on what you mean by solved. So we thought it would be a little clearer to set up the time frames for evidence. In terms of biological material, SB 110 provided that biological material should be kept until the person is off the for the period of time the person is required to register as a sex offender. As a matter of fact, for people who were affected by this bill, people convicted of sexual assault in the first degree and sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree, they are required to register for their entire life. So I understand why you provided an SB 10. This bill just provides that you have to save it for those crimes until the person is off probation or parole or any other condition of their conviction, but it doesn't go as far as for the period of time they have to register as a sex offender. Let's see. The other difference between this bill and SB 241 is the remedies. The remedies are similar, although SB 241 provides that a court cannot reverse or vacate a conviction solely on the basis that a police department has not followed the requirements of this new section. And the reason is this is a new burden on police departments. And right now, there's no law saying you have to retain evidence for any particular period of time. And our rationale was that since we're asking police to do something that they didn't have to do in the past, probably at least at first you wouldn't want to allow a court to reverse a conviction or vacate a conviction if the police department didn't get it right. Finally, the task force is a little different in this bill, and this bill is, the task force is set up a little bit differently because we envision it as a group of people who keep evidence to adopt standards of procedure for the safe storage and retention of evidence so that it is in fact available for post-conviction relief later. We didn't envision it as a policy setting task force that would maybe look at standards for evidence retention in a broader picture. We just had put people who actually retain evidence, who keep evidence, like police and the attorney general, and actually a member of the court system is on the task force just because over the years we have learned that, you know, there is evidence that appears in the basement of court buildings, and the court system probably ought to, you know, pay attention to ought to be represented because they end up whether they want to or not keeping evidence. So I think those are the main differences between SB 110 and SB 214. And in terms of, are there any questions about those particular provisions?
Well, let's see. I was going to actually ask you to start at Section 6, because we are, or at least I am, fairly familiar with the evidence preservation statutes given our history with SB 110.
Okay.
Just kind of walk us through the sections.
Okay.
We've got a few more minutes of the DNA testing procedure, so we've got a good record.
Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe we ought to start with Section 5, which amends the current post-conviction relief statutes by saying that in terms of newly discovered evidence, if you are attempting to get post-conviction DNA testing, that you proceed under the new chapter AS 1273 rather than under current law AS 1272 for other post-conviction relief remedies. And then starting on Section 6, the bill provides that a person convicted of a felony against a person who has been not been unconditionally discharged may apply to the Superior Court for an order for DNA testing. Unconditional discharge is defined in the bill as, you know, the end of parole, probation, everything except sex offender registration. A person who is who wants to make an application for post-conviction relief would have to submit various items to the court, one being an affidavit stating that he or she did not commit the offense for which he or she was convicted or any related offense. They didn't aid or abet the commission of the offense. They didn't commit a lesser included offense. Because the purpose of this bill is to allow a person who's mistakenly convicted, where the criminal justice system simply got the wrong person, not that that
the proof is weak,
right? Or that you know the court didn't give the right instruction, or that the person should have been convicted of a lesser included offense. The person has already had a chance to litigate those issues in an appeal. This is a procedure to correct an error where you just got the wrong person. Another provision requirement for post-conviction relief is that, and maybe it's best to go to the findings that a court has to make. And this is one that we've had disagreements with the Innocence Project, but one of the requirements is that the applicant did not admit or concede guilt in any official proceeding for the offense that was the basis of the conviction. In the other body, we have agreed, and I think that it's we would suggest that this amendment here is an amendment that would say that a guilty plea or a nolo contendere plea on its own is not an admission or concession of guilt, because people do plead guilty for a lot of reasons, not necessarily that they were guilty, but the question is then what is an admission or a concession of guilt. And, you know, certainly a statement under oath in front of a parole board would be something that is a admission of guilt that should preclude a person from bringing from getting post-conviction DNA testing. There are other...
And that's happened. I mean, I know you litigated that, but you might want to tell the committee that turned out to be a fairly contentious...
Sure. In the William Osborne case, Mr. Osborne did admit in front of the parole board that he had committed the offense. And, you know, I know people that, and at that point you want to say, let's not make a mockery of our criminal justice system or what we say to people under oath especially. We think that an admission under oath in the criminal prosecution itself, if a person testified that he or she was acting in self-defense at the trial, then that they should be precluded from coming back after they're convicted and saying, well, gee whiz, I wasn't there, actually. You got the wrong person. So, you know, we have to be responsible. I think we need to hold people responsible for the things that they say under oath in a court of law. But, you know, the entry of a guilty plea by itself or a nolo contendere plea by itself probably should not be considered a concession of guilt for the purposes of this procedure. There are other requirements that are similar, actually, to the requirements for other post-conviction relief procedures, and that is that that the applicant submit an affidavit, or at least try to get an affidavit from his or her trial counsel, explaining, you know, the what happened and the reasons that he or she did not obtain testing in the first place. And just as an aside, as we go through this, you know, we're kind of hoping that these this procedure will go away in the next 20 years, because we look at this as encouraging defendants to get testing at the outset when they're charged. And our state and our state crime lab is in a position to do the testing that is necessary down to a degree of certainty that that in 20 years, you know, whether it's one in a billion or one in a trillion, probably won't make a lot of difference. But we are the bill requires a person to submit an affidavit saying, you know, if they can get it. So, you know, sometimes you can't. Sometimes it's too old, or you can't find your trial lawyer. But you have to either submit the affidavit explaining why, or having that attorney explain the rationale for his or her decision in the trial court, or explain why you were unable to get that affidavit. It would preclude post-conviction DNA testing if the applicant made a decision at the trial court not to proceed for tactical reasons with DNA testing at that point, because we're trying to avoid, you know, well, let's try this one at trial, and if it doesn't work, we'll try another one at post-conviction. So it would preclude that. The federal law does that too. I know there's.
So just so I'm clear, if you have the opportunity to conduct testing at trial and you waive it or decide not to do that, it's waived for good.
Yes.
Okay.
It's waived for good. Right. Or I mean, not. There are other post-conviction remedies that you can proceed with,
this
and that would be
strictly DNA testing.
This is DNA testing, and you might say, well, that was a person might say, well, that was a big mistake that my attorney made on my behalf. Then there might be a procedure for going ahead and claiming that your trial counselor was incompetent or didn't give you good advice. But if he or she made that decision and for tactical reasons generally, for the post-conviction DNA testing, you would be prohibited or precluded from getting testing at this point. Another requirement is that the evidence has to have been preserved and saved in a way that makes it reliable, and that it's described here as subject to a chain of custody, but what it means is people know where the evidence is and it hasn't been tampered with in any way, so whatever test you do will be reliable. And that the testing is reasonable. It's in a scientific method that's consistent with accepted forensic practices, and that the applicant has to identify a theory of defense that is not inconsistent with the theory that he or she pursued at trial, and that would establish his or her innocence. Another requirement would be that if the applicant was convicted after a trial, that the identity of the perpetrator was an issue in the lower court, and that's sort of related to the requirement that the theory that the person is requesting is not inconsistent with trial, with the theory of the trial defense. And then the standard is that is found at page 9, line 25. There's a reasonable probability in light of all the evidence that the DNA testing sought would support the theory of the defense that the defendant has posited and could conclusively establish that the person is innocent of the charges. And those are pretty much the requirements that the bill requires for a person. It also allows, the bill also specifically allows the prosecution and the defendant to agree to post-conviction testing if it's reasonable, and we try to be reasonable on these things. The timeliness is on page 10, and that has been, there's been a lot of discussion about timeliness, so I'd like to discuss that. Right now, it says there's a presumption that the application is timely if it's brought within 3 years from the conviction, and that this may be rebutted if there's been previous applications for post-conviction testing. And there's also a presumption of untimeliness if it's brought after 3 years, and this presumption can be rebutted, and this is the federal law, if the applicant was incompetent or the incompetence contributed to the delay in filing the application or for other good cause. In the other body, we have agreed that it's probably best to just say the presumption can be rebutted for any good cause, because
dropping A and B together.
Yeah, and just say for any good for good cause.
Right. We'll take that suggestion, and thank you.
Yeah, and the reason is, and I know that the Innocence Project disagrees with us, but there is a good reason for doing this sooner rather than later if you can. If you're unable to, if there's a good reason why you haven't brought it within 3 years, then the court should find that you can. But just waiting until people leave, people die, witnesses go away is not a good thing, just to wait. So if you can bring it early, you should, because it's better for everybody. But if you can't, then you should be able to at least show a good cause for that reason.
You've got a couple minutes to wrap up, and then I know we've got committee members who need to be other places.
Okay. Well, I'll just say the bill also does some cleanup work on AS 4441-035B, which is the data bank. These are mainly suggestions made by the Department of Public Safety or clarifying language. For example, our statutes don't specifically provide that a person who has been found innocent can get their DNA out of the data bank. And the federal government has said we need to make that change, and of course we do, because it's the right thing to do. And the task force, as I said before, the task force is a little different from the one in SB 110, because our focus was a little bit different. It was more on technical issues rather than broader policy issues. We're certainly open to, the defense bar wanting to participate. The defense bar generally doesn't keep evidence, but we think they might be bored by being on this committee, but we certainly welcome them to be part of it.
Very good.
And that's it. It's really a balancing act. It's tough to slice it in a way that, makes sure that you don't have innocent people in jail, but at the same time making sure that you don't have people wanting to get another bite at the apple and continue recreational litigation that is not good for anybody.
Ms. Carpignani, thank you for the overview. At a future hearing, we will hear from other interested parties. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.